Welcome to episode 22 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast. My name is Randy Wilkins, and as always, I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirshner. Chris, how are you?
Doing great. First day of a couple days off from being at the ballpark, so not bad at all to get away from the team for a few days.
Did you do any face plants between yesterday and before we recorded this podcast?
The only face plant I did was in my bed from not having to wake up and think about the Yankees that day. So it's nice.
Congratulations. Much better face plant than the one that Alex Verdugo had yesterday.
Yeah, that was it was pretty bad. That was pretty embarrassing.
Sorry, my Alexa's going off in the background. I was trying to save everybody from it. But that was one of the most ridiculous plays I've seen in a long time. Like, just the optics of it were ridiculous. Like, I mean, the entire thing was a shit show as soon as Cedric Mullins hit that ball. I mean, from jump, it was bad. It was bad.
Yeah, I still don't really understand like what happened. Like it was a clear day in Baltimore. You know, it's an easy fly ball, you'd think, to Judge. And it's weird too, because obviously Verdugo's been a really, really good defender this year. Yeah, very strange. That whole ninth inning was bizarre. You know, this year, Clay Holmes, I saw Katie Sharp tweet out that in Holmes's first 39 games, he had 0 four-pitch walks. And then in Sunday's game, he had 2 four-pitch walks. So that was weird. And then Volpe's obviously been one of the best defenders in all of baseball. Bobble's a really easy play that should have ended the game.
Yeah.
So that continues, and then Verdugo, you know, obviously misplays that ball. Just a bizarre sequence of events in the ninth. And not even to mention, Ben Rice would have had the biggest hit of the season so far for the Yankees in the top of the ninth with his three-run homer off of Craig Kimbrell, and that just immediately wasted, like, less than 10 minutes later. Bizarre finish to the first half of the season.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, like the entire weekend and that sequence. I want to go back to Verdugo, though, because, Verdugo and also the Baltimore reaction, which I also found hilarious. So it was the face plant and then the Orioles treating Cedric Mullins like he won the World Series with like a bomb or something. When he had a horrible at bat with like a horrible result, well, horrible execution with like a great result. I know that the Verdugo play was really bad because when the TV cuts to the fielder and he's still coming in, like he didn't just take one step in, he took multiple steps in, and then he does the whole like flailing to go back and then the face plant. I just was completely baffled at what Verdugo was looking at. I mean, you tweeted it out. It had like a 99% catch probability. I mean, it is like a lazy fly ball that wasn't driven. I mean, it was a terrible swing from Mullins. Like, it was terrible. And it's just like the comedy of it. Of that play is what sticks with me. Like the absurdity in the result of that play, but also the actual play itself. Like, what the hell is going on here? Like, what are you doing? What are you looking at? As soon as Mullins hit it, I was like, oh, game's over. We got out of this mess. And then he's like swimming in the outfield. I don't know what he was doing. It was like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, like the only reaction I had to watching it is like, if you're watching a major league outfielder play that ball, like that's a play that, you know, little leaguers can make no problem. It's just very, very strange that, you know, he had that reaction. It was almost like, oh shit, like Cedric hit the ball. Like, I'm not paying attention. Like, I got to look in the sky to see where the ball was. Like, that's really like the only explanation I could possibly have for how he reacted to it.
Yeah. It was just baffling to me. Because off the bat, you're like, oh, the game's over. He's picking up Volpe. And then he's not picking up Volpe. He can't even, like, pick up his feet. Like, he was doing the whole, like, Aaron Boone searching for a good running form thing in left field. And it was just like, this maybe he'll, like, get his footing and he'll catch the ball. And then he did the face plant. And I was just like, that is the end of the Yankees' first half in a nutshell. Like, that basically captured the last month, in my opinion. It was perfect. Perfect.
It was so perfect because the last month, you know, we've been talking about a lot of the miscues they've had, you know, the lack of hustle, the lack of fundamentals. I mean, you couldn't draw up a more perfect way to encapsulate what the hell's been going on with this team over the last month than those final two plays in the ninth inning of Sunday's game. I mean, just perfect. Like, you have a regular routine ground ball to your Gold Glove shortstop and he fails to make the play. And then your likely Gold Glove, at least finalist in Verdugo, can't come up with a routine play in left field. I mean, just a perfect way to describe what has happened with the Yankees in the last 30 games.
Right. So let's talk about Volpe's play, which the Verdugo play was comical to me. The Volpe play is unacceptable. And I think the Verdugo play is worse because that is the play that decided the game. But there's no mistake about it. The Volpe play contributed to the end. It wasn't the deciding factor because of, you know, they were still playing. The Yankees were still winning after he made that error. But that is an absurdly disappointing play from Volpe. That's another play where you're looking at it and you're wondering what is going through his mind. Like, I understand that it's the, you know, the final out. You could sweep them, you know, you take first place. Like, there's context to it. And it feels as if he was aware of the context, it just in the way he played it. Like, he was super passive. You let the ball play him. And it's like, you've had ground balls hit to you to end games before. This isn't the first time this has ever happened in your life or your career. Why are you sitting back on your heels? Like, there's no explanation for being passive there. Just play the ball and you don't even have to throw it to first. Just, you're flipping it to second. Like, just that play was unacceptable. And everybody knows that listens to this. Like, I support Volpe. He was like my big, like, prediction at the beginning of the season, but like, that doesn't really mean anything in this context. He has to make that play. Like, that was just a terrible play from him.
I mean, that's basically what he said after the game when he was asked about, you know, essentially what happened. I don't think it's like a red mark on him now. I mean, it's obviously a mistake, clearly a mistake, can't happen. But he's made so many good plays, and Verdugo too. Like, they've both made so many good plays defensively. What hurts, and I've seen a lot of this online, is, you know, if they can't make those plays, then what are they doing? Because neither of them can hit. Right. So, like, they're not providing anything offensively. So at least, like, you have to make those plays, the routine plays. I honestly would put both of those plays on equal footing just because of the fact that, yes, it was only 5-4 when Volpe made the error. But if he simply makes the play, the game's over and they win 5-3. So, like, both of them are equally bad in my opinion. I get Mullins hit ultimately won Baltimore the game, but, you know, the game should have been over when Holmes got the ground ball from Mountcastle and it's hit to Volpe. And like you said, all he has to do is flip the ball to second. He doesn't even have to make a throw to first. Like, the guy forget who was running a second, but you know, you just flip it a second and the game's over.
Yeah, it was Adley Rutschman.
Rutschman, yeah, that's right. I mean, Clay Holmes also deserves some blame in this spot too. Like, I get he did his job ultimately, but like, he worked into trouble. Like, you know, you walk two guys, you give up a single, you have bases loaded, you're obviously a contact pitcher. You know, again, we've been talking about this for 3 months now. If you're a contact pitcher, some of this stuff happens sometimes because you can't get a strikeout. So, like, he also deserves some blame here for loading the bases himself. Obviously, you know, he did end up doing his job, but still, like, you know, you got to be better than walking two guys, giving up a hit, and putting pressure on your defense to get the job done. Not to say that they shouldn't do their job, obviously, but, you know, he does deserve at least some of the blame here. I would say Holmes is number three on the list, ultimately, because, you know, he did get three outs, four outs.
He got honestly. Four outs.
He got four outs yeah. in that inning. So, like, he did his job. But still, like, it obviously wasn't clean.
Yeah, I know that this isn't going to be popular with people, but I don't really put much blame on Holmes at all. I mean, he got four outs in the inning. He is not the first time that he's – I mean, he's a contact guy who, like, he has iffy command from time to time, which I think is a general knock on him. Like, he has such – dynamic stuff that is hard for him to corral it, and he's a big guy and his mechanics gets out of whack. So I think if you're talking about that, then I think that's just a general criticism of him, regardless of if he gets a 1-2-3 inning or he doesn't. He had the same issues with his command on Friday. I mean, he literally hit somebody in the head. You know what I mean? So I kind of just take that with Holmes because that's his profile. That's who he is. But like yesterday, he did get into trouble, but he did get four outs. You know what I mean? So it's like he did his job and then he went beyond his job. Like, he picked Volpe up essentially, and then Verdugo didn't do his job. So for that specific outing, I'm not going to put that much blame on Holmes because – I mean,
yeah, I mean, to be clear, like, he shouldn't be blamed. Like, I've seen some people be like, Yankees obviously need a new closer. Like, he sucks, whatever. I'm not like saying that,
yeah.
But like, you know, he did ultimately put pressure on the defense in a spot where they had an incredible amount of momentum. And immediately he gives the momentum back to Baltimore by walking, forget who it was, the nine hitter. He strikes out Henderson. I mean, he gives up the single to start the game, strikes out Henderson, walks Rutschman, forget who else he walked. But, like, he did put pressure when the Yankees did have a ton of momentum. I'm not saying he's the reason why they lost. He wasn't the reason why they lost. But, you know, you would at least like him to capitalize on some of the momentum that they had going into the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah, but, I mean – these are routine plays. Like, where is the pressure to catch a fly ball that had?
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, he was like, the reason why the bases were loaded in the first place, though.
Yeah, but
he gave up a hit and two walks.
No, I get that. But, like, he didn't give up a bomb like Kimbrel did it.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just, like, I think that just comes with Clay Holmes. You know what I mean? Like, the innings are not going to be clean. They're never clean. So, like, I think that just comes with the territory of designating Clay Holmes as your closer. So, like, that's why to me it's like, okay, it's just another Clay Holmes experience. Like, we get this almost every game. Like, none of the games are clean with him. I mean, again, he drilled somebody in the head on Friday. You know what I mean? Like, in a game that they needed to win and all that other stuff, and he ends up, unfortunately, hitting – Kjerstad in the head. Like, I don't think he's ever going to throw a clean inning. If he throws a clean inning, then I'm shocked. So it's like,
is that a problem?
I mean, yeah, it's a problem, but like, there's also games where he gets the outs and his defense lets him down. You know what I mean? Like, it just goes back to what we keep talking about with like the lack of swing and miss. Like,
honestly, I think, in my opinion, like, do you want your closer to what you just said, have swing and miss? Like, should the Yankees be looking at replacing Holmes with someone who could strike guys out?
Ideally, yes. But I don't think they're going to do that, though.
No, I don't think so either. Like, I don't. And also, like, when we go through the list of, like, what they need, I don't think closer would be in, like, the top 3 to 4 needs that you would want to improve upon if you could. But I do think, like, you know, if it's Game 5 of the World Series and, you know, Holmes comes in like the 8th and, you know, there's bases loaded, 1 out, like, you're probably giving up at a run there because he doesn't have anything to – he doesn't trust his slider enough, which is his best whiff pitch. Like, his sinker is his obvious go-to pitch. And it's really good when it's on. But the only thing with the sinker is, like, it is a contact pitch. Like, major league hitters will put that in play.
Right.
So I do think, like, ideally, like, you would have someone who can strike guys out, like a Mason Miller type, with Oakland or whoever. I'm not saying like they're trading for him. I would be surprised if they did, but you know, it is at least somewhat of an issue that you have a closer who can't really strike anyone out.
But it's also a problem if he wasn't the closer and he came in the 7th or 8th and it was, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, yeah. So it's just like, it's just Clay Holmes. It's the good and bad of Clay Holmes. You know what I mean? Like, ideally you would want a closer that has swing and miss. And, you know, I guess if you give them truth serum, would they admit to saying, yeah, we probably need somebody that could get a couple more strikeouts than Clay? They might say yes. But again, I don't think they're replacing him. I think we both believe that it's not happening. They'll probably get swing and miss guys in front of Clay Holmes that are not closers, so they don't have to pay closer prices. But I just think that that's what it comes with Clay Holmes, whether he's in the 9th, the 7th, the 8th, the 4th, he gives up ground balls. You know what I mean? He doesn't give up a lot of home runs. He might do it like once in a blue moon, like with Yoshida. Mm-hmm. That's a positive. You just need your defense to make plays. I mean, and hope that like these ground balls don't always find holes, because even the Stowers hit to start off the inning, it's not like he crushed it. I mean, he just found a hole. You know what I mean? Like, if Glaber is playing more towards second base, that's an out. So it's the good and bad of Clay Holmes. I mean, I think he's a really talented pitcher. I think he has nasty stuff. But the one downside is that, you know, they're going to put the ball in play. So they know that at this point, you got to make the plays. It's just, I don't know. I'm repeating myself here, but it just feels like that's the profile, and you're going to have to deal with it as long as he's on the team, regardless of what his role is or could be or whatever. It's just odd that he doesn't have belief in that slider, or is just unable to generate more swing and miss. Like, he should be able to. His stuff is filthy, and it's just weird that the preference is to pitch to contact. That was like 98. It's weird. Like, if you're throwing 98, 97 with all that movement, they really shouldn't be able to put the ball in play as much as they do. It's just his profile, I guess.
Yeah, I don't really understand why he doesn't strike a lot of guys out, because, I mean, when his sinker's on, it's really, really nasty.
Mm-hmm. He's filthy,
it's,
man.
It's weird, yeah. No, it's weird. I saw some people say, like, oh, like, you know, they should put Luke Weaver in the closer role. Well, he also doesn't strike many guys out either.
Anybody out.
So it's like you're not really doing anything differently if you move Weaver to the 9th and put Holmes in the 8th. Like, they're still similar guys. Like, obviously Weaver has had excellent results this year, been a revelation. Like, Brian Cashman deserves a lot of credit for that signing, because even when it happened in the offseason, I was like, huh? Like, really? Like, this guy had 13 innings last year with the Yankees, and obviously, like, he did well in those 13 innings as a starter, but you know, they gave him like real money, and I didn't understand that move at all. But he's been fantastic. Like, he's certainly across baseball been one of the better under the radar moves from this past offseason that have worked out. But I still wouldn't put him in the ninth inning because it's really the same with Clay and Luke.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and Luke gives you multiple innings of high quality production. So I think his role is the right one. And I mean, they just need to add guys in front of Holmes that has swing and miss. You know, it's just, I don't think Holmes is going anywhere as a closer right now, unless he just totally falls off a cliff, which could always happen, I guess, but I don't think it's going to happen.
What I would be interested in is if like they trade for someone like Tanner Scott, who's the Marlins closer, a lot of swing and miss, an all-star, really good.
Deserves. A lot of walks.
He does walk a lot of guys. So I would be interested to see if they traded for him, like what they would do. Like, would they put Scott in the ninth or would they put him in the eighth?
Right. Yeah. Well, hopefully they get Tanner Scott and then we could find out what they're thinking.
That would be a good problem to have for sure. Because,
oh, yeah.
You know, they certainly need another top of the line bullpen arm, which we've been saying again for
since
3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
we've been saying, I think we were talking about this like in the Guardian series.
Yeah, exactly. We were. I was just like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on from that part of the series, the Yankees take 2 of 3. They finally end their losing streak with series. Do you think that despite the horrible ending in the ninth of the last game, that this was a pretty important series win for them? And do you think that going with the whole like turning the corner thing, and I know you wrote about this, do you think that this is an indication that they are actually turning the corner?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, the goodwill that they built up Friday and Saturday was erased with how Sunday went. Like, they probably, like the organization would probably disagree with my assessment there. But when you have an opportunity to sweep the team that is obviously going to be in the race until the end, and you crumble the way you did, like, I'm sorry, like, that's not an indicator of your team turning the corner. Like, you, what we talked about, I think either last episode or two episodes ago, when a team like the Reds is coming to town and you don't look at that as food, like, you have to do the same, you have to have that same mindset in Sunday's game, especially one where you just took the lead in the top of the ninth. Like, you have to close that game out. So, like, no, I don't think that's like an indicator of turning the corner, like Boone said. Like, that just in another example of the poor play that they've shown over the past month. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I don't think you can say like you're turning the corner after that. Like, obviously it's great that they won 2 of 3 against Baltimore. It's a big deal. You know, they go into the September series though, after losing Sunday's game, needing to sweep the Orioles to win the season series. And this division race is likely going to come down to a few games. You needed that type, like, you needed to put yourself in a position where you're going into that September series at 5-5 for the series record, and you win 2 of 3 at home, and you get the tiebreaker if it's necessary. Now you have to sweep the Orioles. So, I mean, in my opinion, I do think that Sunday's game was the worst loss of the season with just how everything transpired. And I do think that like Friday and Saturday's results were erased because of how Sunday's game transpired.
Yeah, I agree. And I also found something very odd about Boone's comments after the games, when he was talking about the we've turned the corner, and he used Tampa as like the line of demarcation from, you know, they were starting to compete in Tampa. And we talked about this for a while about the lack of compete and lack of effort and hustle. And to me, that comment pretty much admits that up until that Tampa series, that it was an issue and Boone wasn't forthcoming in speaking about that before the Tampa series. Now, after the fact, he's admitting or basically telling us that, yeah, this was an issue before we got to Tampa. And I thought it was bizarre to use Tampa as like the line when they lost that series. They weren't right, good at Tampa.
Exactly. It was like, right, exactly.
What part of the Tampa series was encouraging?
Even the game they won. They won that game 2-1.
Right.
Like they won that game because Yandy Diaz threw the ball into left field when Glaber was running to second to avoid a double play. And I believe Trent Grisham had a sack fly. Was how they got their other run in that game. It wasn't like they hit well or anything, which has obviously been an issue too over the past month. Like they won because Tampa made a few more mistakes. That's it.
And they went into that Tampa series with each pitcher going into that game having an issue with their biggest pitch. And then each pitcher that struggled with their main pitch completely shut them down. And it was like, Ryan Pepiot has been terrible, and his changeup has been awful. Like, they talked about it ad nauseum about how bad his changeup has been, and then he gets, like, 800 strikeouts on a changeup. Then Shane Baz, who, like, is just getting his footing back after his injury, who was horrific the game before, their second and third, no outs or whatever it was, and they don't score. Like, I don't know what Boone was looking at in that series to make you think that there was something positive to take into that Baltimore series. I just think Baltimore is playing just as bad as the Yankees, and somebody had to win those games, because I don't think there's anybody listening to this that watched those games and felt like Baltimore was some like juggernaut. They were bad. They look just as bad as the Yankees. And the only reason they didn't get swept was because the Yankees decided to make the last mistakes of the game. You know what I mean? Like, somebody had to win that series, and you're two teams that are playing terribly. Baltimore got swept by the Cubs coming into that series. The Yankees lost to Tampa. Tampa and the Cubs are not good. So somebody had to do something. And I would even venture to say, Brandon Hyde kind of motivated the Yankees to snap out of it. It wasn't even anything that the Yankees did. Brandon Hyde being a bozo after Kershaw got hit kind of just like woke the Yankees up a little bit, which was ridiculous on Hyde's part. Like, I get the emotion, but just popping off at everybody when it was clearly a mistake and wasn't intentional was absurd, but it also kind of like woke the Yankees up for at least a game. So I don't know what Aaron Boone saw that the rest of us didn't see to make you think that they were turning a corner, and to say that after your left fielder face planted in left field on a play that had a 99% catch probability, and a play before that, your gold glove shortstop looked like he had never seen a ground ball before. So I'm not here to bash Boone. It's just like curious. Like, I just don't understand like what the line of thinking is when he says these things right after something bad happens. It's just like, we get you're trying to protect your guys, but like, again, we're not idiots. Like, we just saw what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing to say after how that game ended, but you know, to be fair to him, like, he did acknowledge that, you know, losing that game was a killer,
right,
and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's just weird because of how everything that has led up to that point from, you know, the past 30 games, it was just another reminder of how sloppy the Yankees have been over these past 30 games. And, you know, to say you're turning a corner, it's like, what corner are we turning?
Right. Where's the corner at?
I don't see the corner. I mean, I wear glasses, so maybe like I may have to get a new prescription, but I don't see the corner.
I don't see the corner either. I saw a guy face plant on the corner or in the middle of the sidewalk or the middle of the street trying to beat traffic. And then my man almost got hit by a car.
We can reassess like if they've actually turned the corner at the end of the month, though, because like they have a brutal stretch coming up. They have 4 against Tampa this weekend at home, 2 against the Mets, 3 on the road against Boston, and then 3 on the road against Philly, surrounded by the trade deadline during that series. So it's a really brutal stretch coming up. So, you know, if Boone thinks like they're turning the corner, you know, that should mean that they win most of those games coming up, which I don't think they will, truthfully, with how they've been playing. You know, maybe I turn out to be wrong, but, you know, I would not bet on the Yankees coming out of this 2-week stretch with over a 500 record against these teams with how they've been playing. Like, I don't have any reason to think like they are going to win the majority of these series and just the individual games themselves.
All right. So we'll get into that more after this break. We'll start to look ahead and see where the Yankees could be headed in the second half. So we'll be back right after this break. And we're back. It's Randy. It's Chris. Before we went to the break, Chris, you started bringing up the Yankees schedule to start off the second half of the season. It is not an easy one. We also mentioned that Aaron Boone had talked about the Yankees potentially turning the corner, or in his mind, they were already well on their way to doing that. We obviously don't agree with that, but I just want to say before we get into the schedule, looking ahead into the second half, I tweeted about this today. I think that this trade deadline is going to be one of the most important trade deadlines in a long time for Major League Baseball, not just the Yankees. Because if you look at the AL, since we're a Yankees podcast, we'll focus on the AL here. There isn't a dominant team, as far as I'm concerned. There isn't one team that I look at and I'm like, oh, man, we got to catch those guys, or the Yankees have to catch those guys. I think, and I've said this multiple times, so I'm going to say it again, especially because this past series kind of cemented this for me. The Yankees and the Orioles are neck and neck. They're even. You can go to certain parts of their roster and say one is better than the other, or this is stronger than the other, but in a collective sense, the Yankees and the Orioles are neck and neck. Their strengths are their strengths, their weaknesses are their weaknesses, and it just brings them together. You can see it in the standings. You can see it when they play. I don't think right now, speaking right now, there's any evidence that one team will blow by the other one. Cleveland, whatever. I know that they're a good team. I don't take them lightly, but like an AL Central team has to prove itself to me, and I think the entire league, for them to get that benefit of the doubt. Minnesota, same thing, whatever, especially Minnesota. Seattle, definitely whatever. The Astros might come back and take that division because the rest of the division is not good, but even that Astros team is not like what it used to be. There isn't one dominant team here, and it feels like the race to address as many holes in your roster is going to make the difference in the American League. That's probably true in the National League, even with the Phillies there. But in the American League, I can't remember a trade deadline that mattered so much to so many top teams in the league than this one. Like, it just feels like that's going to be the big difference. And whether a team can kind of separate itself from the pack, stay in the pack, or fall behind the pack. And I guess you could throw Boston in there, but I've already on record saying I don't by that team. I mean, I think they're decent, but they would definitely need the deadline to like make me think that there's somebody worth like considering as an actual threat heading into the playoffs. So I just don't see the AL having that team right now. And can you remember a trade deadline that has so much weight and importance and has the potential to influence a race like this one?
Not recently, because, you know, for the past few years, it's felt like whoever becomes the number one contender has to go through the Astros. Every single year, it's been like that for the past several seasons now. Whether the Astros win the World Series or not, it just felt like whoever that number two team is, like they still have to go through the Astros. So this year, I'm in an agreement with you that it doesn't feel like there's that team that, oh, like we have to get through the Twins this year. Like there isn't that one team where it's like you have to get through them to get to the World Series, because I feel like any of these teams in the American League could win. Like there's not a team that's like separated themselves from the pack. Like I've said it numerous times now, I think the Yankees are one of the teams that could win the World Series.
I agree.
They certainly are. But they haven't separated themselves from the other teams in the American League yet. So it certainly is an important trade deadline coming up. The only thing that I think would make me nervous is if I was a general manager is that I don't know how many teams are selling. Like we're still 2 weeks away, and basically the entire National League is still in the playoff race. And, you know, you have the Marlins, the Rockies, the White Sox, like all these contending teams are going to be, you know, picking at the corpses of these like three teams who are like for sure sellers. And, you know, if I'm the Yankees, like, yeah, like their trade, I mean, their minor league system is good, but it's not as good as some of these other contending teams. Like the Orioles can make whatever move they want. If they want to Garrett Crochet tomorrow, they can make something happen. The Dodgers have a really good farm system. The Phillies have a good farm system. Like those teams can make whatever move they wanted. And I do think that the Yankees have shown some restraint when it comes to just trading whoever. Like Hal Steinbrenner is on record back in February saying, I don't want to trade Spencer Jones, Will Warren, and I believe Chase Hampton was the other guy. He said, you know, he said this on the record. Obviously, people's opinions can change, and we haven't spoken to Hal in a while to say, hey, are you comfortable trading Spencer Jones if it means getting Garrett Crochet? Like, I don't know what his thinking is. But when it comes to trading, like, yes, you know, Cashman makes the moves, but he still needs approval from Hal Steinbrenner at the end of the day. Like, if Hal Steinbrenner says, I think Spencer Jones is my center fielder for the next 20 years, I don't know if he's going to be comfortable trading him for whoever comes available. So that's one aspect of this that I don't know, is how Hal feels about certain players. But, you know, I've been saying this since December now. You have 1 year of Juan Soto guaranteed. You have to do what it takes to build a roster out that is a legitimate number one or number two contender going into October. If it means trading Spencer Jones for Garrett Crochet, if like you think that's the piece that puts you over the top, then so be it. Like you have to capitalize on a year where you have this player who's going to become a free agent. Like you have to do what it takes. So I'm very interested to see what the Yankees end up doing in the next 2 weeks, because it is a really critical time for them. Like they do have the makings of, you know, being in a spot, being in their best spot of winning a title since 2009, just with like the talent they have on this team. Obviously there are holes, but they do have the base to build upon. And I'm very curious to see what happens.
Right. I mean, amidst all this stuff that we've talked about and pointed out, and the way some people talk about the team online, the Yankees have accomplished what they needed to accomplish in the first half, which is establish that base that you're talking about that gives them an opportunity to be a true contender in the playoffs. Like, you don't win a championship in April, May, June, and July, but you put yourself in a position to win in the playoffs now. And I think the Yankees, despite the inconsistent play over the last month, have done that. I mean, they've played better for longer than they have, like, struggled.
And 100%.
I think we have to keep that in mind.
And I was just about to say that, because, like, I've seen so many people just, like, write this team off. And it's like, I get it. Like, they've been terrible for a month now. I totally get it. But you also have to realize, like, what you just said, like, they've played better than they've been bad.
Right.
They've played more games where they look like they are one of the one or two best teams in baseball than they've been for these past 30 games where they've been one of the worst teams.
Yeah. I mean, I think,
and that's not to diminish, like,
the
flaws that they have shown over the past 30 games. Like, there's no denying that they need to fill some of the holes that they have on the roster. Like, and if they don't fill those holes, you know, it is at least a little bit concerning, because, like, there are some areas on this team that are easily exploitable when the competition's obviously good in October. So, like, they have to fill those holes. Like, right now, I think they're one of the teams that can win the World Series, but, you know, there are a few spots on their roster where it's like, shit, like, I got to rely on this guy. I have to rely on this guy. I have to rely on this guy. So, like, if you patch some of those holes up, you definitely put yourself in a really good spot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they have put themselves in a position to make the moves that are necessary to really go for it. And it's not like last year where, you know, they come out of the break and they're a mid team and then they get embarrassed by Colorado and the Angels, and you know right then and there that the season's over. They have not put themselves in that position in the slightest this year. So all you have to do is look back to last year where you were at the All-Star break and how you're hanging on by a thread, and, you know, 6-7 games later, your season is over. They're not in that position by any stretch of the imagination. But as we've said now and in the past, the level of play has to improve. It's not just like the holes. It's the plays, the level of play from the players that they have right now is inconsistent, and it's been happening for too long now. So, like, the face plant can't happen. Anthony Volpe not playing like a routine ground ball when you need to win the game can't happen. So it's like, yes, there are holes, but also, like, that sloppy play that we always talk about, you have to minimize it somehow, some way, whatever the solution is, you have to find it and then execute it.
But yeah. I don't think that's going to continue. I would be very surprised if the sloppy play continued August 15th, September 15th. Like, if that does, they're not winning the World Series, and, like, forget about it.
But based on what, though? Because, like, this is kind of like a calling card of these Yankees. So, like, what is that?
It's definitely been creeping up over this past month, but, like, I don't think that aspect of the team is going to continue.
See,
I would be surprised. I would be very surprised if that continued moving forward. Like, that would be one of the lowest concerns I would have when analyzing this team.
See, I feel like that threat is always around the corner with this team. Like, if we're talking about around the corner and turn the corner and the corner, where's the corner? I feel like that stretch of sloppy play is always lurking somewhere with this team, because we've seen Aaron Boone as a manager of the Yankees for 7 years now. And every year you can point to multiple stretches where you're, and it's different players. You know, it's not like this is entirely the same roster. They've turned this roster over pretty significantly over the last couple of years, and you still have the same problem. So it's like, I get what you're saying. I'm not guaranteeing it's going to happen, but to me, it's always there. Like, and if it popped up again, I wouldn't be surprised, because we've seen it so many times that it just feels like that is a characteristic of the Yankees at this point, because it happens so much with so many different players that it's like, yeah, there's ebbs and flows to a season and there are bad stretches, but it's like the things that contribute to the bad stretches always feel like it's the same thing, like from year to year. So for me personally, I can't let that go. We've seen it too many times for me to confidently say what you're saying.
Just, yeah, I mean, like, that's, as an observer. That's certainly fair. I would just have like underperformance as a higher concern than sloppiness.
Oh yeah. Yes, totally. I'm not saying that that's the driver. I'm not saying that that's the primary driver.
I'm just saying
it's a contributor.
Yeah. Like, I mean, certainly a contributor.
Yeah. Like, underperformance is the issue here. Like, and we all know the names. Like, you can look at the entire infield outside of Ben Rice and say underperformance is the issue here. So yeah, that's the number one problem. Like, DJ LeMahieu can't get at bats anymore, like regular at bats anymore. Like, that just can't happen. Like, what are we doing?
Let me ask you a question with that one in particular. What's the difference between DJ and Volpe? They're both good defenders.
I think, totally valid question.
Because I see a lot of people just hating on DJ, and obviously he's not good this year. I'm just curious. I'm just asking a question because they are both very good defenders. Neither of them can hit.
No, they can't. And totally valid question. And for me, it's a couple things. Volpe's defensive value and like athleticism trumps whatever DJ LeMahieu's defensive value is. So like, Volpe's such a good defender. Like, he should be in the platinum glove conversation by the end of the year. Not to say he's going to win it, but he should be under consideration. So like, his defensive value is higher than LeMahieu's. He's also doing it at short. Two, I don't know who replaces Volpe. Like, they don't have a shortstop replacement. So it's kind of like, who's going to, there's nobody there. You're not
John Birdie.
I'm not putting John Birdie at short. I mean,
like, I mean, he could play it.
I haven't even seen John Birdie. Like, he's turning into like Ben Rortvedt to me. So it's like, right now they don't have a replacement. So part of it is just, I don't even know who the other option is. The other thing too is, as a corner infielder, he has more at bats right now than Trent Grisham, and he has 3 extra base hits, and they're all doubles. There's not a home run there. There's not a triple. And you're playing a position that requires power output. Mm-hmm. And he, at this point, is incapable. Like, we've seen enough. He's incapable of driving the ball. I know Anthony Volpe can drive the ball. His approach has basically taught him to not do it, which is a different issue than being physically incapable of driving a ball. Like, DJ LeMahieu can no longer drive a baseball on the major league level. And it's like painfully obvious. I know Volpe can, but he's choosing not to do it, which also is unacceptable. Like, they're both unacceptable for different reasons, but at least I know one guy is capable. So yeah, like, the question is totally valid, because Volpe's been ass as a hitter, which like frustrates me to no end, because I thought that the swing changes were meant to complement the power, not subtract the power, which makes no sense.
I thought the same thing. And I wrote in my story on Monday that, like, I personally got caught up in the hype that, like, the Yankees were selling.
Well, I did, like, too. But, I mean, I certainly did. But I thought there was good reason to be to buy into it.
100%. 100%. I made a mistake. I got caught up in it. And it's also, like, moving forward, it's also a very good reminder when – so, like, those first, like, 2 or 3 weeks where Volpe was, like, one of the best players in baseball, it's such an important reminder that I think he only had, like, 2 home runs in that stretch. But he still wasn't hitting the ball all that hard in those first 2 to 3 weeks. Like, a lot of his hits were finding grass, which is not a strategy in Major League Baseball. Like, it's not a strategy. Like, that's a strategy in Little League for sure, because, like, defense is just not good. And, you know, you're not playing guys who are going to, you know, Division One, Division Two, even freaking Division Three. Like, finding grass is not a strategy. And it just seemed like that was the strategy. Like, he had a 448 BABIP in his first 3 weeks. And if a player, like, you could have a 448 BABIP in 3 weeks, but you better be like Aaron Judge, where you're just absolutely destroying the ball and you have like 10 home runs and, you know, you're hitting every ball at over 95 miles an hour. I certainly would get that because it's such a small sample size. But when you have a 448 BABIP and it's mostly singles, you know, moving forward, like, I have to put that in my head. Like, okay, like, do not get caught up in this hype because this guy is just hitting singles. And eventually these singles will stop finding grass, because it's no hitter can be that lucky if you're not driving the ball gap to gap or whatever, or hitting the ball over the fence. Like, no hitter is going to sustain that level of success if you're just a singles hitter, which is what Volpe was in those first 2 to 3 weeks. He had great results, obviously, but it was so impossible to continue moving forward. Like, even like from the, I looked this up yesterday, from April 10th, the day that Volpe went to the leadoff spot, to now, his BABIP is 290. And the major league average for BABIP is 289. So he's not even getting lucky at all. Like, this is just the plain results. And the plain results are really, really terrible. Like, he's not a good hitter.
Yeah, and the thing that I don't understand is, he was 20-20 last year. He hit 20 home runs as a rookie and he struggled in other areas. Why would you take away the one thing that you were, like, good at?
I do have a theory. My theory may be wrong. They would never tell me this if I asked anyway. I do wonder if the fan pressure that Volpe had, where he hit 209, he was obviously struggling tremendously in June. I do wonder if, like, the amount of, I wouldn't say vitriol, but, like, the amount of, like, disgust that a lot of fans expressed over him hitting 209, where he was hitting like 180 something at that point in June. I do wonder if, like, had Volpe change his approach to become more contact oriented, where, you know, he could get on base, he can steal, he can hit, you know, 280, 290, and everything would be great, and people would get off their backs, because they did change some of their organizational approach this offseason. Like, they traded for Verdugo, who's just a contact guy. I highly doubt Volpe came up with this plan himself, but now he's a contact guy. Oswaldo Cabrera, now a solely contact guy. I do wonder if, like, some of that got in their heads and said, you know, let's, you know, placate the fan base a little bit here and change your approach. It's a theory. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it is absolutely bizarre that he has this approach this year. It doesn't work. Like it can't work.
No,
because he's not Luis Arraez. He's not Stephen Kwan. Like those guys do have, and Arraez is struggling now too, but those guys have really, 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 really elite contact skills. Volpe's not that guy. And he wasn't that guy in the minor leagues too. Like he was a power guy in the minors.
Right.
But they completely changed his approach.
It makes no sense. And like, if your theory is spot on, maybe the disgust from this year will knock some sense into somebody's head and say, you know what, go back to what you were doing and like, just be a little bit more selective at the plate.
Like, yeah. Which he wasn't last year because he was chasing and right. You know, he didn't have the discipline.
Yeah,
but like I would rather a player have a 209 batting average, which is what Volpe had last year, but he also hit 21 home runs. Like that is more impactful than what he's doing this year. I think he has the same OPS this year that he finished with last year. Let me check and see.
Yeah, I mean that is the most frustrating thing because I believe Anthony Volpe is a talented hitter, but the transition to being a slap hitter and you're like 23 years old and you just came off a 2020 season makes no sense. And like when I made my bold prediction of him being a top five shortstop, that was off the idea that the power was there and he had made some adjustments to complement and enhance the power with like better discipline. And if like he didn't have a pitch he could drive, he could go the other way or something because he changed his bat path. There was no indication or belief or anything to suggest that he was just going to completely sacrifice his power. Like even to your defense, like getting caught up in the hype, I don't really think you got caught up in the hype because at that time, there's no reason to believe that he's going to sacrifice his power. Like he just has, he decided or someone decided with him and he went along with it because he's young and he's like trusting people, which I totally get, to just decide that power didn't matter anymore. And it's like, I don't know if it's the organization. I don't know if it was him in the organization. I don't know if it was like his personal hitting coach with the organization or like whatever it was. And whoever was involved, they have to reevaluate it. His offensive profile and contribution starts with power, which in the modern day, that's what you want. You have a shortstop that has displayed at the very least 20 home run power. So to me, that's your baseline. So now you're like, okay, can you hit 25 this year? Is there ever a point in your career that you hit 30? Not sitting on six for 2 months. Like I don't remember a ball in the last 2 months that he's hit where I'm like, oh, that might go out. There's not one at bat where I'm like, oh man, he crushed that and he just missed it. I like, it's just these little slap hits to right field and he like kind of accidentally will drive a ball in the gap. And it's like, man, just hit the crap out of the ball. Like, you could do it. You're capable of doing it. You've proven it. Just hit the crap out of the ball. Because whatever you're doing now, it doesn't work. So you might as well, let's try something else now. Let's go back to what we were a little bit before with a little bit better discipline, obviously, to, like, be more productive. Like, he's been on six home runs for, it has to be, like, 2 months now because – every time I see his stats pop up, I'm like, he's still on six.
Like, I think it's been over like 250 plate appearances since his last home.
Come on, man. Come on.
And I just looked it up. He has a 666 OPS, which is what he's
good.
it's what he finished with last year as well.
That's not good.
Yeah.
For many reasons.
Yeah. I think he saw Long Legs this weekend, the Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah.
Might have. By the way, it was an amazing movie. I actually saw it the other day.
Was it? Yeah. I've seen mixed things about it. So
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I it's weird to say this. It's like hard for me to watch movies now. I don't know why.
See, I'm a movie guy. I have AMC A-list. I go.
Oh, okay. I can see it in the. I have to go to the theater to watch a movie. It's like really hard for me to like stream movies and stream series because I think I'm like, okay, I've watched a little bit of this, but I know this is on. So let me go watch this. I think if I'm in a theater, then I'm like locked in and I enjoy going to the theater. But I can't always do it. And I don't think there are enough movies to like motivate me to do it. Like good movies, in my opinion, to like go watch one in the theater. But yeah, I need to do a better job of that. But I just know when I like stream at home, I think I almost have to like watch it with someone to like force me to like watch it. Like even with House of the Dragon, like I'm into it. I love Game of Thrones, all those things. But like I noticed that, you know, I'll watch some of it and then like I don't know if I have like all of a sudden when it comes to watching something, I have like a short attention span all of a sudden, but I'm like, oh, I know this is on. So I'm going to go watch this or like the Yankee game is on or, you know, the Euro final is, on. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, I just all of a sudden just start bouncing around with like my viewing habits.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to get distracted when you're at home. That's partly why I do like going to the theater because, you know, I'm not one of those who's like on their phone, like checking Instagram every minute. Like I enjoy going to the movies in the afternoon where it's me and like the 60 and 70 year olds who are in retirement and I can, you know, not have to worry about the teenager next to me who's talking. Like I enjoy, maybe this is me in my old age at 32 years old talking. Cause like, I don't like going to the movies when it's like Friday night.
Oh no, I don't ever do that. I've watched pretty much like every movie I've watched in the theater since before the pandemic. It's like smack dab in the middle of the day, like random time, random screening. I go to that. I'm good. I don't want to be there with like 9 million people like talking and being on their phone.
Yeah, it's
like,
terrible. It's just ruins the entire experience.
Yeah.
Like I saw, this is not a movie podcast, so I apologize for people who are turning this off now. But I saw Sing Sing the other day about the, I don't know if you've seen reviews about that. Sing Sing, you know, it's a prison here in New York, like 30 miles outside of the city. These group of prisoners started this theater program. It's a true story.
Right.
And Coleman Domingo's the star. Absolutely incredible movie. Highly recommend it. I'm sure it's going to be in Oscar conversations next February. Just a remarkable movie. Just well done. The actors that are actually in this movie, I think it's Coleman Domingo and Paul Racy are the only two actors, and the rest of the actors are former prisoners of Sing Sing who were actually in the theater program. So, really, really well done.
That's good. Nice. I'll have to check it out. I know of it. I just haven't seen it. All right. So we're going to go to break so we can end the movie conversations. We can start another podcast where we can just talk about our viewing habits and stuff. So we will come back after this break with the mailbag and then we'll wrap it up. So we'll be back right after this break. And we're back. It's mailbag time. Hal Gordon. Hello, Chris and Randy. I'm writing this as the first inning ended after Nestor gives a home run up to Arozarena. Oh, wow. He wrote this a while ago. Does anyone in the organization know why road Nestor is horrendous while home Nestor is a Cy Young candidate? Why is it taking so long to get road and Nestor right? I appreciate y'all reading my mailbag last week. Try to keep it shorter this time. Thank you for keeping it shorter this time. So, road Nestor, what's the problem?
Yeah. They've been saying the same thing for the past couple months now, that there is no explanation for it. And I do agree with them. like a lot of this I feel like is random. Like he's not pitching differently. He doesn't have a different routine on the road. It, like a lot of this sometimes is randomness, and it's not like a great answer. It doesn't explain anything, but sometimes that's just how baseball is. Like there's not really any rhyme or reason why Nestor has struggled on the road this year. Like that's, it's a bad answer, but it's the only answer that they have. And I have, truthfully, like I've looked at the numbers, like how he's pitching, the movement, like none of that is different. I just think that he's having his bad outings on the road. That's it.
Yeah. I don't really have much to add because I have no idea, to be quite honest. Could just be variance, I guess. Thank you for your question. Leonard Tusa. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Hi, Chris and Randy. Love following both of you guys for your opinion on the Yankees. Wanted to ask, is this a legacy-defining most important trade deadline for Brian Cashman in his tenure with New York? And based on your opinions, do you believe in him to do a good job based on how his recent acquisitions in general have gone? Verdugo, Gallo, Donaldson, Gray. Okay.
Number one, I don't think this is a legacy defining trade deadline for him. He is a, hate him or not, he is a future Hall of Fame executive. His legacy is defined. He has multiple championships. Yeah. He's going to the Hall of Fame. I know fans, a lot of fans don't like him, but he is a Hall of Famer. This is not a legacy defining trade deadline for him. It's important, obviously, for sure, because of what we were saying earlier with having Soto on your team and needing to capitalize on that. But no, it's not a legacy defining trade deadline for him. And also, like, regarding the moves he's made, you know, it is, I'm not like being a shill for Cashman when I say this, but like, trading for guys in the middle of the season is hard. And, you know, sometimes those guys you trade for were performing well with their previous team. They get to their new team, they struggle, it takes an adjustment. It's hard. Like it's not like an exact science when you trade for guys. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But some of the guys you trade for, like I do think that some of the profiles that they've traded for, Donaldson, where it was clear that he was nearing the end and he was so, I don't want to say, yeah, I mean, like his answer when he traded for Donaldson was a little arrogant. Like it's Josh Donaldson. Like he was talking like he traded for a guy who was 27 in the middle of his prime. When like some of the numbers would suggest that it wasn't the case. Joey Gallo, like the thinking was there. Like I understood the thinking of why they traded for Gallo. It simply just didn't work out. Right. Frankie Montas, if the player says he's healthy, the medical records say he's healthy, but it turns out like the player wasn't telling the truth, which Frankie admitted himself. Like he was like, yeah, I wasn't actually 100% healthy, even though I said it. It's like, what are the Yankees supposed to do about that? Like how are they supposed to know? So right. It's like some of these, like there is context that is needed when evaluating the moves. Like some of these moves haven't worked out. Some of them have worked out. That's just the nature of the business.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's basically how I feel, especially on the Gallo one. When Gallo first got here, everybody was excited and the whole like Rizzo Gallo Italian guy thing was like, everybody was fired up about it. I mean,
everyone has been clamoring for, why don't we have a left-handed power hitter?
Right.
Why aren't we taking advantage of the short porch? And it's like, they got that guy. It just didn't work.
Right. And then there's other moves that have definitely worked. So, yeah, I mean, it comes with the territory, like you said. Do I have confidence in him? Yeah. I have confidence in him. I mean, I think the Donaldson trade was terrible.
It was egregious.
And I think in the moment, you knew that it probably wasn't going to work out, especially with IKF being part of it and playing short. Like that was just a bad move. But I think the other ones made sense. And I think most people were positive about it. And then it just, in some cases, it didn't work out. So I think,
yeah,
I definitely think he's making moves. Might be more difficult this year, but I mean, I have confidence in them. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't.
The Donaldson move was so bad because they made that trade basically to get rid of Gary Sanchez, when all they had to do if they wanted to get rid of Sanchez so badly was simply DFA him.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't need to take on $50 million of Donaldson's salary. And, you know, they threw in IKF, obviously, in that deal to be the shortstop stopgap for Volpe or Peraza. But it was such a misallocation of resources that, you know, you can just hit free agency and get a stopgap on the market there instead of taking $50 million in Donaldson's salary when that money could have been used elsewhere to fill other holes. Like, that wasn't, it was such an unnecessary move.
Yeah, it was a terrible move, and I'd love to know what actually the thinking was there and what those conversations were. We'll never find out, but that was unquestionably a terrible move. That in some ways I think they're still feeling the effects of, to be quite honest. Marcus Gray, power ranking some potential Yankee trade targets. If you had the power rank potential available position players at the trade deadline for the Yankees, who would be your top three? Mine personally would be Jazz, Chisholm. I like the power speed combo along with the defensive versatility. He has potential to be a really good leadoff hitter in front of Soto and Judge, and he needs some athleticism outside of Volpe, and he could be a real spark plug in terms of energy. Renjifo, I don't love Renjifo, but he has experience at third base, and you have less DJ starts going forward. Paredes, I really like Paredes, but I don't know if the Rays would be willing to move him at this moment. Plus, I hate trading with the Rays in any circumstance, given their track record. He would be higher on my list if he wasn't on the Rays. Honorable mention, Brandon Lau. I really like Lau, but the injuries he's had the last couple of seasons gives me some concern.
Well, I already did my trade big board a few days ago on The Athletic.
There we
go. How I did it was Jonathan India was number one. The Yankees need a solidified leadoff hitter. His on-base percentage is like .380. Second base is obviously in need. He played third base at Florida, and which is where I went to school, but it's not why he's number one. He's under contract for next year as well. He's playing really, really well. I don't know if the Reds will move him. They do have a logjam in their infield, so, you know, it's possible that they could decide to part with him, especially if they can get something, you know, valuable in return. I had Matt Chapman number two. You know, we talked about DJ, like, you know, it's obvious he's near the end of the line. Chapman still hits the ball really, really hard. He fits what the Yankees usually look for in their hitters, someone with high exit velocity numbers, someone who can do damage, and Chapman is still doing damage with the Giants. He's also likely going to be a free agent at the end of the year, so it doesn't, like, hurt them with money on their books for Soto, which, you know, Hal has made it very clear that the payroll is unsustainable, so they're likely going to make cuts. So he'll be off the books because I don't think he is going to pick up his option. He actually already has said that. So I expect Chapman to be on the free agent market again this upcoming year. And I had a curveball for my third one. I had Brent Rooker as my third position player. You know, a lot of people are obviously clamoring for Jason Dominguez to return. I don't know if Dominguez is returning this year, truthfully, because when he is fully healthy, it's going to be like nearing the end of August, and he's going to have to do another rehab assignment at that point. So we're probably talking at some point in September when he could be an option. And at that point, he would have missed almost the entirety of this season. And you're asking this guy to join the major league roster, having very little experience, and you're likely suggesting that he's going to be an everyday player when he's missed the entirety of the season. The Yankees are trying to win a World Series this year. It's possible that, like, that decision could work out. Again, if I'm Cashman and I'm building this team, like, I'm not putting my eggs in that basket. Like, I'm trying to make a decision where I know someone could help me now. And Rooker hits the ball extremely hard. He would probably frustrate the hell out of Yankee fans, though, because he is a high strikeout player. But what he does do is he hits home runs, and the Yankees have been missing that since Stanton has gone down. Like, really, the only guys who are hitting home runs are Judge and Soto and sometimes Ben Rice and Austin Wells. Like, that's not enough. Like, if you add Brent Rooker to the middle of this lineup, like, you have a really, you know, good middle of the order, especially if Stanton can return to form, which, again, like, I don't know if that's going to happen because he's usually not the same. He hasn't been the same over these past few years when he has returned. But Rooker is one of the most underrated players in the league, and he fills your DH spot, and he has like a 900 OPS. Like, I want that guy in my lineup. And if they can't find a space for him, figure it out. Like, I would put Rooker in left field over Verdugo, honestly.
Yeah, I want a Rooker Urseg package. Like, let's just kill two birds with one stone with one team. Get the bat, get the reliever, get them out of Oakland, put them in pinstripes, and make another move or two, and let's go. Like,
that would be Rooker, a great deadline if they could.
Yeah, I mean, Rooker has definitely jumped up my list. I am sure I'm in the minority here, but, like, I've said this before, I think the leadoff talk is a little overblown. They need guys in the middle of the lineup. I mean, every single game, you're just getting after Judge, nothing. How many cleanup hitters have they had in the last, like, week? It's just like an audition now. And Glaber is not doing a job. Whoever's batting sixth is not doing a job. Seventh, outside of Wells, like, it's a revolving door. And I know
they gotta get Verdugo out of the middle of the order.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
it makes no, like, I don't understand the thinking there. Like, I
don't either.
I got the thinking a bit when Stanton was healthy and you wanted to change pace in between, you know, your two power hitters, but, like, he hasn't hit in 2 months. Why is he hitting fourth? Why Austin Wells moved up to fourth? Why is he sixth?
It's bizarre. Like, I don't, the middle of the order is the issue with this lineup. Like, there is,
but I think it could be fixable, like, in the interim. Like, obviously it's not great, but just literally simply move Austin Wells right behind Judge, hit him fourth, and Trent Grisham, whether people like it or not, he's been performing. I would put him fifth. Like, those are your five best hitters right now have been Ben Rice, Judge, Soto, Wells, Grisham. It's not ideal, but those are the options right now. Why aren't those guys your top five hitters?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I'm just saying in the context of, like, trade targets, like, if you can get a leadoff guy, great, but I don't think that's addressing the fact that you have Alex Verdugo as your cleanup, Torres is your five hitter, and he's not doing anything. I mean, he's hitting, but he's not driving the ball like that. You know, it's just Wells, Grisham. I mean, it's like the middle of the lineup. I've been saying it for a while now. That's the problem. So, like, if you get a power guy who can also hit lefties, you know, you need a, it's weird to say this, you need a righty bat after all the years where it was just nothing but righties. Now they need a righty bat, like, one more guy to combat, like, these lefties. They need a power bat. Like, and if you could get Jazz Chisholm, because they're just sick of Jazz and they just want to get him out of there and get that little bit of money off their payroll, great. Like, fantastic. But, like, you need a power guy. And to me, the one that out of the the guesses, I guess, of like going through this process of who's available or not, like Rooker shoots to the top of my list. It would be Paredes. I said Paredes before, but that's, I don't think that's happening. So
no.
Rooker and Ursaeg would be my package. And then if you can get a Jack Flaherty, I've been saying this for a while, like Jack Flaherty should be a Yankee. Part of that is because that's my guy, like on a personal level, but like he helps the rotation. Like he's having a very good year and he pitched well against the Dodgers. I would get Jack Flaherty in here because I don't think you're getting Garrett Crochet. I think if he's going somewhere, it's Baltimore because they can pay that price, no problem. So like Flaherty's the next best guy of the people that we know are available. Like get a power bat, get a reliever, get two relievers if you can, and get a starter. Because we haven't talked about this at all, but Rodon is terrible. He's awful. Like, they need a starter. He's terrible. Like, he's the one guy that you can't trust right now, in my opinion. Like, he's just pitch mix, no pitch mix, fastball, no fastball. It doesn't matter. Like, he can't throw a strike consistently. He can't give you any type of like length innings wise. He's giving up home runs left and right. Like, it's not working out with Rodon. Like, he's been bad. He's been like really bad lately.
Yeah. I mean, even in, you know, Sunday's game, he only gave up two runs. He was damn lucky to give up two runs only.
Yeah.
Because he was not good at all. Like,
he was terrible. Yeah, he
got seven strikeouts, whatever. But when you're viewing it as on the whole, he was awful.
Yeah.
Like, it's great that, like, he decided to change up his, you know, his sequencing, because like that was clearly necessary after the past four or five outings where it's like, all right, you know, we're facing Carlos Rodon today. Let's sit on the fastball. We know he's going to throw it. And okay, the next time out, all right, yeah, we're going to sit fastball and we're going to score. The next time we'll sit fastball. It's like, what the hell? Like, well, how was that not changed? So at least he changed it on Sunday. But still, it's like if you can't throw strikes consistently, you're no good as a starter. And that's been one of his big issues too. It's like, yeah, the fastball is not good anymore, but he also can't throw strikes consistently. And he doesn't know where the pitches are going. You're on mute.
Sorry. He has no idea where the ball's going. And there's a lot of times where he throws a ball that's like so far out of the zone. And then he has like that look where it seems like he's hurt, but he's like processing, like, yeah, how did the ball get
back of the mound and like,
yeah,
his shoulder.
Right. Or he's like off to the side of the mound and he's like looking at his finger, and like Austin Wells or somebody is like looking at him alarmed. And he's like, give me the ball. Because he just realized that, you know, he threw the ball 30 feet away from the strike zone. You know, it's like, I will say this. I was all for the move when they signed him. I thought it was a good move at the time. Speaking of moves that you think work and then you realize they don't, this is not working.
I do want to say, I think I'll give myself credit, because I believe I wrote at the time that this move was very, very risky. Yeah. And, you know, it's turned out to be a bad risk. Because he's under contract now for four more years. I don't know how this gets better, truthfully. I don't know.
I have no idea. Like, I think they need to bring a starter in, to be quite honest. I mean, I don't think it's at the top of the list of priorities. You know, if they're able to get one, great. They can probably, I mean, they can't get by, you know, with who they have and Rodon just being bad and you figure it out. But, you know, in an ideal world, you're bringing in another starter. Just, I mean, it's not working. This is not working with Rodon, and I don't see how they can trust him at this point. Like, I mean, just the total inefficiency is a problem. You know, it's just not good. It's not good. And it's frustrating to watch, like, just like aesthetically. I mean, when you don't know when the pitcher's going to throw a strike, it's just like a frustrating watch. You know,
it's a slog to get through.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, he got lucky getting away with those two runs, because if this was a Baltimore from like a month ago,
oh my God, he's out in two innings.
Yeah, like it's home run derby. Like, in honor of the derby tonight, he would have had the derby on Sunday. Like, they just would have been teeing off on him. So he caught them at the right time to only give up two runs in four innings and like hit the showers afterwards. You know, he's been bad. So we had some other questions, but we've pretty much answered them as we've done the podcast. So sorry for not actually reading your emails, but feels like we covered a lot of those subjects. So we appreciate everybody sending in emails. Please continue to do so. At least a great conversations and points that we might not be thinking about at the time. So we appreciate them. So any final thoughts before we get out of here?
I'll just plug the email real quickly. If you're not on Twitter or you found this podcast, if you want to write in a question, it's bf314podcast@gmail. Other than that, I'm excited to watch the Home Run Derby. I love the Home Run Derby. I've loved it since I was a kid. It's obviously not the same as it was when I was growing up, but I still enjoy it. My thought with the Home Run Derby, they'll never do this because it would be such a risk, but I would love metal bats.
Oh my God, they would kill somebody.
Yeah, I just don't think you can do it, because it's like, imagine like Giancarlo with a metal bat. Like, he might hit it like 600 feet at like 150 miles an hour.
Right.
They couldn't have the kids in the outfield like shagging the balls.
They would kill
somebody. But it would be so much fun.
I went to the Home Run Derby when they were in LA a couple years ago, when Julio Rodriguez had like 800 home runs in that one round. Yep. It was remarkable to see that live. You're just like, this is like so easy for them. Like, it's just, that's really when you can see like how gifted these guys are. Mm-hmm. When you can just, because now you're like kind of feeling the pace in real time with them. Like on TV, you can kind of feel it, but because they have to cover so many like angles and all that stuff, you don't really get a true feel for it unless you're like in the building. And the pace at which all of these rounds go, just for each individual hitter, is like remarkable. And it's remarkable that they don't pass out. You know what I mean?
It's exhausting.
They're like firing these pitches at these guys and they're just teeing off. And it's like, you can see like 30 or 40 pitches in like, what is it, 2 minutes or something like that? It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah,
it is wild.
Yeah. That's the thing that that you can't capture on television. Just like the pace of each round for each guy, you know, and like why they get so tired after each round. So that was a great experience to have like in person and at Dodger Stadium. You know, that was pretty awesome. So.
I do want to see a home run derby one day.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, the Athletic usually just sends our national writers. So unless the All-Star game comes back to Yankee Stadium or I make a trip by myself, I don't know. I'll be seeing one anytime soon.
It's worth a trip if you can do it. Like, it's cool. Like, it's cooler to see it in person than on TV, just because, again, it's like a hard event to broadcast. Mm-hmm. But to see it and like feel it and watch like how far these balls go, it's pretty cool. It's worth the trip for sure. Especially if you're like in a good city.
I should definitely do it one year, especially because like I am part of the media. So it's not like I'll have to spend on a ticket. Like I can get in with a media credential. So,
right.
And like the, I've seen the prices on some of these tickets, like it's expensive to,
oh, it's crazy
to get in.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
So like that's one expense that I don't have to pay for myself.
Yeah. I got MLB like hooked us up.
That is nice.
So yeah. So we had good seats. Like we were second deck right behind home plate, which was like perfect.
That is nice. You
know? Yeah. So, all right, well, we'll wrap this edition up. Obviously, there won't be any games until Friday, so we won't do any live streams or a second podcast this week. So we will speak to you all next week.